Thank you, Olivia. Okay, good morning. Today's topic is conflicts of interest in judicial proceedings. And I want to highlight the distinctions between the halakhic approach towards these types of issues on the one hand and the secular law approach, just as an initial matter. In secular law, those who train to be attorneys learn certain rules about the necessity to avoid conflicts of interest, and the focus of these rules is primarily upon judges and attorneys, that if one is serving as a judge, it's important not to have an interest in the outcome of the case, obviously, and one would have to recuse themselves. And if one is serving as an attorney, they can't have a conflict that would lead them to potentially not be as aggressive an advocate for the side that has selected them, so that if there had been a prior or ongoing association with the other side or with the subject matter, an attorney also has to recuse himself or herself. Interestingly, halakha also has a focus on conflict of interest rules, what's called nogeya bedavar, that one has to recuse oneself if one is a judge in a matter and there is a potential interest in the outcome of the litigation, or there is an association with one of the parties. That's called nogeya bedavar. There isn't, however, the same focus whatsoever with respect to attorneys, because halacha doesn't really have the same construct altogether of an institution of attorney. It's something which really cropped up later on. La'acha chasimas ha-Talmud, a notion of an advocate, a rabbinic advocate. In general, attorneys were discouraged. And there isn't a literature so much, although we'll see a little bit, with respect to conflicts of interest when it comes to attorneys. The bigger focus, from the standpoint of halacha, other than in the realm of judges, is in the realm of witnesses. If somebody is going to be an aide, if they're going to be a witness, then there was a need for the person to be entirely impartial, not to have an interest in the outcome of the litigation, and not to have a very strong relationship with one of the parties. This emphasis on witnesses from the perspective of halacha is really not found in secular law at all. There is a possibility of somebody being a witness in a case, despite the fact that they're even a spouse, or they are a very strong associate or ally or enemy of one of the parties, and there is no automatic disqualification from the perspective of at least American law. It's something which perhaps is understood that it should be taken into account and testimony of such sort rendered with a grain of salt, but most of the conflict of interest, the rules when it comes to attorneys from the perspective of American law is found with respect to expert witnesses. Because what happens with expert witnesses is that in a given industry, if there is an esoteric point that's being debated, say that it's a case where Much depends upon a medical examiner's determination of a type of injury that was inflicted. So there are certain reigning experts in every single field, and people explore experts to recruit when they're going to present cases before a court. And it is not unheard of where somebody will explore the possibility of one expert, decide they're not going to use that person, and then the other side will recruit that expert. And the question is, did this person find out enough information or establish a relationship with the first party so that they would be disqualified from serving as an expert for the second party, because maybe they learned certain confidential information from the first party that could then be used to the detriment of the first party. So only in that very limited realm of an expert witness do you find that there is more developed secular law doctrine And the other area that exists from the perspective of secular law doesn't really exist from the standpoint of halacha is with respect to jurors. Since we, in the halakhic system, have dayanim, we have judges who decide cases, we don't really have this notion of a jury, while in secular law, in addition to the judges who are responsible for overseeing the procedural correctness of a case that's presented before court, often the ones who decide the case, who actually hand down the verdict, are the jurors themselves. The jurors also, on a certain level, function as judges, so therefore there's a certain amount of conflict of interest doctrine with respect to jurors. That's the best way to get disqualified from having to serve on a jury and to be released from jury duty is to establish some type of conflict of interest. I mean, I had the good fortune, I guess you could say, of turning a bad situation into a more positive one in one instance in which I was called for jury duty a number of years ago in the Bronx. And a week before I was supposed to serve on jury duty, I had a very unpleasant experience on the highway where I was speeding on my way home, I guess, or at least going at a fast enough speed so that it drew the attention of a police car. And I had been visiting my father had been ill at the time, and my wife and I had visited my father, and we were in a rush to get back home so that we could relieve the babysitter and get back to our kids. And we were stopped by a police officer on the highway, and he took a much longer time than usual to write the ticket. And we were wondering what's taking him so long, and then he came back to the car and he told me that I should get out of the car, which is very unusual. And then he said, "Do you know that you're wanted for arrest?" And I said, "Well, I have a guilty conscience, but I don't think that I'm actually wanted for arrest." And he said, "Well, here's the driver's license, and you're telling me that there's somebody else by the same name at the same address, you know, who's not you?" And then he proceeded to lead me to his police car, and before I knew it, he actually put handcuffs on me and threw me into the back seat of the car. And my wife, of course, was getting, you know, somewhat hysterical, and he was telling her, you drive, and you follow us, I'm going to take him to the police station." And I, you know, sat there in the back of the car, and I said to the guy as calmly as I could, I think you have the wrong guy. And it sounded like maybe he had heard that before. But I said, "No, I think this time you really, really have the wrong guy, and maybe you should just double check." And then he made a phone call as we began to drive, and then he put down the phone and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, it looks like you're correct." And then he called out in his loudspeaker, and my wife should stop her car, and then we got out, and he took off my handcuffs and just gave me the ticket for speeding. I went on with life, but I was somewhat shaken by the experience. Anyway, the following week, I was called for jury duty, and I showed up, and I was about to be put on a jury panel for a case, and the case involved a man who was arrested for drunk driving, and the other litigant in the case before the court was the police officer who arrested him. The question as to whether this was a properly administered arrest or not, and I was asked whether there's any reason why I felt that I couldn't serve on this case. And I said, "Well, to be perfectly honest, I was wrongly arrested the previous week, and right now I'm not feeling very warm and cuddly feelings towards police officers. So I don't know for sure whether this would prejudice me in this case, but you know, I just feel I should share that with you." And they said, "You're excused." So there is this notion also with respect to jurors that we have in secular law, that the jurors are also functioning in some capacity as judges, and therefore if there is a conflict of interest, that would be applicable to jurors as well. But focusing on the Jewish law perspective, so certainly when it comes to judges, we say that they would be disqualified if there is a conflict of interest of some sort. And we say the same with respect to witnesses. Do we have such a notion when it comes to attorneys at all? So the first source in the materials is really the one that would be probably the most applicable to attorneys, and that is that there is a notion of lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol. There is a notion that you're not supposed to place a stumbling block before a blind person. And Rashi, in his commentary to this pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, says that this also means that if somebody is blind when it comes to particular advice, that they just don't know better and they come to you for advice, you shouldn't give advice that is not suitable or helpful to them. You shouldn't say, go and sell your field and buy a donkey instead, which the person thinks you're giving as impartial, objective, neutral, helpful advice. But really what's going on is that you want to purchase this fellow's field, and that's why you are encouraging him to sell it, not because it's good for him or that a donkey is going to be more valuable than the field. In fact, he'd be much better off with the valuable field than with the dying donkey. That's okay for Allah benot la himenu, and you immediately after the field leaves his hands, you either buy it from a third party, or maybe you even arrange that you're going to buy it directly, pretending that you're doing him a favor, but really you have a conflict of interest because of the fact that you want the field. So this too translates into the realm of any kind of advice that or counsel that you render to somebody. So if you are representing somebody, but you're actually interested in the subject matter of the case or of this person's possessions, and you are representing the person because you want to get something out of it that is not consistent with the person's interests, you're representing somebody with respect to a real estate case, and you are a real estate magnate in the community, and you are offering advice which will enable you eventually to take advantage of this person's assets. So although this is not the classic nogeya bedavar, the classic conflict of interest which is discussed in the halakhic sources with respect to judges or witnesses, nonetheless, this would be prohibited as a manifestation of lifnei iver. What about the expert witness type of scenario that I mentioned to you, where you're in possession of confidential information regarding one party, and now you're asked to, and now you're going to represent somebody else who might benefit from that confidential information? So this was a very interesting responsum, which is found already going back to 15th century Germany, from the Posek Mahari Baruna. And the Mahari Baruna was asked about the following really fascinating case, where there were rabbinic advocates who were representing different sides of a case. One rabbinic advocate was representing a man by the name of Shimon and his wife Adel. We'll call them the Adel family. And the Adel family had a dispute with Yosef Munchen. So Yosef Munchen had this big fight with the Adel family, and one of the advocates who had been representing the Adels switched sides in the middle of the litigation after serving for half of the litigation, serving Shimon and his wife, Adel. This person, Avraham Katz, is actually mentioned by name, switched sides and began to represent Yosef Munchen. And the Shimon and his wife Adel complained to the Dayanim, to the judges of the case, that this should be impermissible because Shimon Katz, who had been serving as a rabbinic advocate for them, knew all kinds of confidential information. Shezeh yada kosodo shelahem, knew all of their secrets and all of their weaknesses. Ve'akshav yodea liton v'lamed, and now the person would be able to use that to their disadvantage by representing the other party. V'ratzu l'posol lios toin shelahem, and therefore they wanted to invalidate this person from serving as a rabbinic advocate for the other side. The conclusion is quite startling, probably not the conclusion that I would have assumed would be the case. And he says, "Upasakna she'ein lana l'posel medina." We rule that we can't really, as from the strict letter of the law, we can't really invalidate this toin, this rabbinic advocate, for serving for the other side. Why is that? What was the reasoning? So the reasoning was, well, the mamolim ain't no toin, let's say we're not going to let the person serve as a rabbinic advocate. He still knows all the secrets, and he still went over to the other side, so he's still going to share all the secrets with them anyway. Even if he doesn't appear in the court, he's still going to share everything with them. So therefore, what are we solving if we just don't let the person represent them in the actual court proceeding? Secretly on the side, he could teach them everything that he wants. So this, I think, flagged a different problem, which is the problem that we still have to this very day when it comes to the field of rabbinic advocates, and that's the problem that there were no set of disciplinary rules or ethical conduct that they needed to follow, and therefore there was no possibility of anybody being disbarred. In other words, they didn't have the ability as officers of the court to prohibit this individual from sharing his secrets or doing anything of the sort, since there was no ability to prohibit the person from sharing whatever confidential information the person knew. And therefore, it just didn't make sense in the opinion of the Mari Baruna to invalidate this person from serving as an advocate merely on the basis of this conflict of interest because he was in possession of confidential information. Then he says, Shabbat Salibesi, when I came home, which means when he spoke to his wife, Nimlachti. So I asked her if you know, she thought this was a good decision on my part. So whether this is something I should do in the future, and then came to the conclusion, I guess, after chatting with his wife, that I wouldn't allow this again. And why is that? Because he quotes from a Talmudic passage that there's such a thing as having certain ethical rules that are above and beyond the letter of the law, even if there's no strict halacha that might say otherwise, that even something which is completely permissible according to the strict sources, nonetheless, that if it's unethical, it should be avoided because of the verse in the Bible, that you should not engage in action that's going to cause people to murmur against you for being somebody who is less than pristine in their ethical behavior. And then he adds, and this is, I think, an important point and kind of a nod to whatever were the secular legal principles that existed at the time that have subsequently, I think, been developed even further, that even those who are in the non-Jewish societies, machikim mizeh, they distance themselves from this type of a conflict, that if somebody chooses an attorney, then that attorney is not allowed to switch sides in the middle. So certainly, if that is what the law is in secular society, then certainly that should be applicable to us. That we are obligated to sanctify ourselves, even with respect to those things that we can argue should otherwise be permitted. But obviously, the correct fix in this situation is not only what his final conclusion was, but to have some sort of a system where if there are attorneys operating within the system, there are rules and there are checks and balances that are put into place that would ensure that, number one, there not be violations of lifnei iver, that there not be violations of somebody counseling a party in a way which is contrary to that party's interest because of the self-serving motivations of the counselor or the attorney, as the case it may be. And number two, that there be strict rules that if somebody was in possession of confidential information, that from one side that could be detrimental to the other side, that it's not proper, it's not ethically proper to then represent the other side in the dispute. Now, there is another realm that exists in halacha, in Jewish law, that really is outside of a normal judicial context. That you might see in typical conflict of interest rules, and that is in the realm of Issur V'Hetter, when it comes to ritual law, when it comes to ritual decisions. Is this piece of meat kosher, or is this piece of meat trafe? Things of that variety. And here, the general rule is that a person has the right to make, if they are qualified, if they are a halakhic authority, to make ritual pronouncements and decisions despite the fact that they might be a beneficiary. Like, for example, there's a kashrus question that arises in your kitchen. and you happen to be a rabbinic authority who knows how to decide rules of kashrus. So even though you're a beneficiary, if you decide that something is kosher, because then your family is going to have a larger meal, then you're not going to have to buy something else, and you're going to save money as a result, since fundamentally it's a ritual decision, so then the halacha is, this is a Gemara in Erevin, then the halacha is that somebody who's a Tzorben Merabban and somebody who's a Talmid Chacham is allowed to paskin on ritual decisions, even though they're going to be a beneficiary of the psak. There are certain exceptions that are carved out, and there's a question as to whether the exceptions are what we would describe in the realm of midas chasidus, just very high ethical behavior, or whether they are strictly required. The most obvious example, we find the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that's source number 3. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that when decisions were made as to whether to add an extra month to the year, now we have a fixed calendar, and this year, for example, is a leap year. We're about to enter into a leap month in just several days. We'll have an Adar Rishon followed by an Adar Sheni. But it used to be that every single year, this would be a separate determination that would be made by the court as to whether the year, for various considerations, would warrant being extended by an extra month. And the Gemara says that there are two individuals who are not allowed to participate in those deliberations. One is the melech, one is the king, and the other is the kohen gadol. And what's the reason? So the Gemara says, well, the king because of the apsanya, and the kohen gadol because of the tzina. What does that mean? Apsanya means that there were certain soldiers that needed to be paid by the king every single year, and the king would always pay them a set sum for the entire year. So if there was a leap month, then the king got an extra month of work for no extra cost. So therefore, the king would always be interested in making it a leap year because he would get the extra month of service for no extra cost. And with respect to the Kohen Gadol, the concern was tzina, was cold. What do you mean the concern was cold? Was the cold? Did the Kohen Gadol live in Chicago? I mean, here we're talking about Eretz Yisrael, so what exactly was the concern with respect to the cold weather? So the answer is that the later on that Yom Kippur would fall, then the colder it would be because the more into the winter it would get. And the Kohen Gadol had to do, as Tosfos points out, had to do his service in the Beis HaMikdash with his bare feet. And therefore, he would get cold. Rashi says the problem is he would have to go into the mikvah, and the mikvah was cold. But Tosfos says, yeah, but they warmed up the mikvah, so that's not necessarily a fatal problem. But the bare feet on the floor was certainly very problematic, and the Kohen Gadol didn't want that. So therefore, he wouldn't want it to be a leap year, because he wanted Yom Kippur to fall the next year as early as possible, so it wouldn't be during the really cold weather yet. So even though these might not necessarily seem like the most compelling of reasons, but because there were certain negias, there were certain conflicts of interest that existed, therefore they were disqualified even from this type of a ritual determination. So the Chazon Ish, who was quoted by Rabbi Magentz earlier, the Chazon Ish, in his sefer called Emuna U'Bitachon, he wrote a book about the importance of having proper faith and proper trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is a philosophical work, but the Chazon Ish was a halakhic authority, so he couldn't resist the temptation of throwing in a little bit of halakha in anything that he wrote. So in his sefer, Emuna U'Bitachon, the Chazon Ish has an extensive discussion about rules of conflicts of interest and where they come from and when they are applicable. And the Chazon Ish says that as a general matter, when it comes to matters of ritual prohibition or ritual law, there is no concern with respect to conflicts of interest because we assume that every single posek will be able to rise above that. But when it came to determinations of extending the year, that was performed in a fashion that was considered like mishpat. It was considered like a judicial proceeding. So whenever a ritual determination is made in the context of a judicial proceeding, so then one has to take into account any potential conflict of interest, because then the rabbis are not serving merely as poskim, but they also are serving as members of the courts, and then the judicial rules of conflicts of interest come into play and have to be reckoned with, and that's why they would have to remove themselves from that type of determination. But the truth of the matter is that whenever the ritual determination becomes more of a monetary determination than a ritual determination, there are rules of conduct that are found elsewhere in halacha that dictate that the person, the judicial, the halachic authority in question should remove themselves from making the determination. So that, for example, if you had a talmid chacham who knew how to shecht a chicken, so the talmid chacham is allowed to shecht the chicken for himself and make the determination that the chicken is kosher. But if the talmid chacham would be shechting chickens and shechting cattle for the entire community and would be paid as the shochet for the entire community, so then the halacha is, and this is quoted by Rav Moshe Feinstein as well, then the halacha is that the talmid chacham would not be allowed to be both the shochet and the merchant who is selling the meat, because if there would be a potential incentive to rule that things were kosher in order to make more of a profit. So therefore, in this realm, there are certain cases where we are stringent because of the recognition that even if it wouldn't be a strict conflict of interest issue from a judicial perspective, it would at least have an appearance of impropriety, shall we say, so that it would have the appearance of a conflict of interest, which the halakha also believes in refraining from, based on the principle which is quoted by the Mahari Bruna of Haseh Mimcha Akshus Peh, that you should try to abstain from any type of action which is going to cause people to murmur against you that perhaps your motivations were not completely pristine. But how far do we take this concept even in the judicial context? So this is an interesting discussion that is perhaps also best developed in the Gemara in Ksuvos in source number 5, where the Gemara in Ksuvos talks about shochet, talks about bribes. So bribes, we understand, are prohibited based on the principle of osasu avil b'mishpat, that you're not allowed to engage in a perverted judgment to decide a certain way based on a bribe. But the actual prohibition of taking bribes, of losikach shochet, says the Gemara, is not only in the obvious case where you would be violating losasu avil b'mishpat, where you would be perverting justice, but the Gemara says a person is judged, is not allowed to take a bribe, even to decide a case correctly. Even if one of the litigants says, here's $100,000, and I'm not giving this to you to decide in my favor, I'm just giving it to you so that you'll do the right thing. Because I want to encourage righteous behavior. So even that, says the Gemara, is prohibited. Why is it prohibited? So here, the Chazon Ish has really a very astonishing chiddush insight. And the Chazon Ish says that really all of the laws of bribery that are not cases where the person is directly asked to distort the judgment are based on this principle of negius, are based on the principle that once a person has received money or a favor or something from one side, they're going to be tilted, even without meaning to be, even without intentionally wanting to be, they're going to be tilted in favor of the side that gave them something. And sometimes, says the Chazon Ish, this is going to be prohibited as a matter of strict law, and sometimes it's going, in other cases which are perhaps a little bit more removed, it's going to be prohibited as a matter of midas chasidus, as a matter of righteous behavior, even if it's far enough removed that it would not be strictly prohibited from a technical halachic perspective. So the Gemara gives a few examples of this. Hekidami shochet dvarim. The Gemara talks about what if the dayan, the judge, didn't get money, but just had an experience that would cause them to be generously inclined towards one of the parties. Kihad the Shmuel hava ava b'mibra. Like the case where Shmuel was crossing over a bridge, and then somebody else came along and just helped him, gave him a hand to cross over the bridge. So and Shmuel said, oh, what's your connection? What are you doing here helping me to cross this precarious bridge? So Amalei Dina Isli. So he said, well, it just so happens I have a Din Torah with you today. So Amalei Pasil Nalach Ledina. So Shmuel said, I can't serve as your dayan anymore. And similarly, Amemar Yosef Kadayin Dina. Amemar was also he was in the middle of deciding a case. He was sitting down in his capacity in the courtroom. Par Gadfa Areshe, and a bird flew on top of his head. So Asa Ahal Gavra, so one of the people who was sitting in the room, he didn't have a case at that moment in time, but he was sitting in the courtroom, came in Shaklei, and he pushed the bird off of Amemer's head. So Amalei, Mayavitech, so Amemer asked, what are you doing here? Amalei, Dina Isli, says, well, I have a case that's going to be heard by you a little later today. So Amalei Pasil Nalach Lidina, he said, well, then I have to disqualify myself from serving as a dayan. And the Gemara has many cases like this, including actually a case of Rabbi Yishmael Bar Elisha, who was a Kohen, who had a man just bring him a gift that is supposed to be given to Kohanim anyway. It was something that rightfully would go to him because he was a Kohen. The first shearings of the wool of the person's sheep, it's called Reishis HaGeiz, but the person lived far away. And Rabbi Shmuel Bar Elisha was suspicious. He said, how come you're giving me your first shearings as opposed to a different Kohen? And the person said, oh, well, Dina Eastley. It happens that I have a din Torah with you anyway, so I figure once I'm coming here and I have a judicial proceeding in front of you, I may as well give you these shearings. Now, this wasn't ill-gotten gains on the one hand, because this was something that was supposed to be given to a Kohen, Rabbi Elisha, Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha was a Kohen, but nonetheless, because it wouldn't have gone to him otherwise, it would have gone to a different Kohen, so this was sufficient for him to disqualify himself from sitting on the case. So Tosfos over there says that these were cases where there was no actual money that was given. These were not the types of things that were outright bribes, shall we say, but because they would cause somebody to tilt themselves, their inclinations in favor of this one party, that would itself create a type of conflict of interest, a type of negius, a type of connection with the party and with the outcome of the case, and therefore a judge under these circumstances would be obligated or would have to recuse himself, not as a matter of strict halacha, not as a matter of technical law, but as a matter, says Tosfos, of midas chasidus, of going above and beyond the letter of the law in all of these types of cases. I remember once that I had this question arise in the context of Mishloach Manos. They asked the question, what if a party generally gives somebody Mishloach Manos, gives them just a gift of food on Purim, which lots of people give each other if they live in the same community, and then the judge who received Mishloach Manos from somebody has a Din Torah in which they have to adjudicate a case with that person later on. So here too, you would have to ask the question, is there perhaps a close connection that had been created because of the giving of the Mishloach Manos? You would have to be particularly stringent if it was in this type of circumstance where the person didn't normally give Mishloach Manos to the Dayan and then it just happened to give Mishloach Manos when there was going to be a court case before that judge that was occurring the next week. So I had a case where I had adjudicated a matter in the context of a Zabla proceeding where each party chooses a dayan and the two dayanim choose a third dayan, and we had adjudicated the case and we heard the case and we issued a decision, and then maybe a year or two later there were some new disputes that broke out between the parties, and it was a divorce case. And there was a question as to whether they would come back to the same panel. And as this was being deliberated, I suddenly discovered I got a package from UPS of Mishloach Manos from the side that had selected me in the proceeding. And I called the person up and I said, why did you send me this Mishloach Manos? And they said, well, just I thought it's Purim and it's a nice thing to send Mishloach Manos. But normally, Mishloach Manos is something that's sent by your neighbor, not somebody who's sending it for UPS. And I said, well, it's given that the relationship is such that we only know each other through the dinto, I can't accept this Mishloach Manos, so I'm going to have to send it back to you. And I did. I don't know if it was still edible at that point, but I sent back the Mishloach Manos on this basis, and I recused myself being involved in the proceeding afterwards, because this is the principle that's articulated. Even if it's something that might be done in the normal course, if it's done in the normal course only in the backdrop of there being a din Torah proceeding, so then recusal is appropriate under those circumstances. If you're serving as a dayan in a case, then you're supposed to be an objective party. You're asking a good question. Is there a difference between a Zabla case and a regular Din Torah? So the Rama says there is, in the following sense. What if you happen to be a friend of the party? So if you happen to be a friend of the party, then the Shulchan Aruch rules, the Code of Jewish Law rules, that here we actually make a distinction between a witness and a judge. That when it comes to a witness, we say that the mere fact that you're friendly with somebody does not, as long as you don't have an interest in the outcome of the proceeding, but you just happen to have a friendship with somebody, so we don't think that this is going to cause somebody to testify falsely. This runs to the question of what is the halakhic basis for prohibiting a conflict of interest altogether. So when it comes to a witness, there is a dispute between the Rosh and the Rambam as to whether the nature of the disqualification is that you're essentially like a baal dover, that you're considered to be a party to the dispute. A party to the dispute is not a valid witness for himself or herself. If you're a party to the dispute, that's what the Rosh says, or whether it's based on what the Rambam says, kshash mishaker, that we're just worried that you're going to lie. So if the fear is that we're just worried you're going to lie, so the commentary, the smat to the Shulchan Aruch, the beginning of Siman Lamed Gimel, says that when it comes to a witness, the mere fact that you're a friend is not reason for us to think that you're going to lie about what happened, because you're just testifying as to what occurred in the case, and we're not worried that you're going to distort the facts. However, says the smat, if you're a dayan, if you're serving as a judge, so then we have a different concern. What's the nature of the different concern that we have? The different concern that we have is that when you're serving as a dayan, it's not that we're just worried you're going to lie. Where a dayan isn't testifying about what happened, a dayan is supposed to analyze the case. A dayan is involved in the svara, the analysis of the case. And we're worried that in the course of the analysis of the case, your relationship with the person is going to cause you to be tilted in favor of that party. So the Rama says that while this is true for a regular dayan, that for a regular dayan, a regular judge, the fact that they are friendly with one of the parties, as long as they're not like their shushbino. Shushbino means that they were like the best man at their wedding or something like that. But if they're just like, an acquaintance, they get along, they schmooze with each other at Kiddush, you know, and maybe invite each other to their simcha, stuff like that. So he said that that wouldn't be a disqualification for a witness, but it would be a disqualification for a judge. However, if the judge is being selected to be a borer in a Zabla case, where each side is picking a judge, and it's understood that they want to pick somebody who's going to be sympathetic to their case, so then it wouldn't be a disqualification merely to be a friend. Nonetheless, while it's understood that a judge under those circumstances might be more sympathetic, or it might be legitimate for a judge in a Zabla proceeding to exhibit sympathy, the judge is also supposed to be objective and neutral, so that after they sympathetically think of anything which might be beneficial to their side, they still realize that the other side has more merit to their case. They're supposed to theoretically still be able to decide in favor of the other side. So anything that would be in the realm of shochad, in the realm of an actual bribe or an actual favor which would tilt them much more seriously in favor of this side against the other side, and which would not enable them to be objective altogether, that would be more problematic even in the context of a zabla proceeding. But it is actually a very good question. Now, another question that arises is, can a judge renounce the connection that the judge has with the case? Can the judge renounce the conflict of interest? So here, this would seem also to depend to some degree on whether the disqualification based on conflict of interest is based on a chashash mishakir, based on a fear the person's going to lie in order to get a benefit, or whether they are a baal dover, whether they are considered like the party themselves. If somebody has an interest in terms of being the party himself, of being a relative of the party, so then even if you cease to be a relative afterwards, you can't renounce your interest in the case if when the case began, it's what we call tkilaso bipsul, that when it began, you had a conflict with sofo bikashrus, and at the end, you don't have the conflict anymore. If it's based on just that we're worried you're going to tell the truth because you have an interest in the outcome, so then as long as you no longer have the interest, it should be okay either to testify as a witness or to serve as a judge. So here, when it comes to conflict of interest rules, the Gemara in Baba Basra indicates very clearly that renouncing one's conflict of interest should actually work. The nature of the case involved a Sefer Torah, that there was a Sefer Torah that was stolen from a certain community, and the question was, could anybody who was a judge within that community serve on a Din Torah regarding the possession of the Sefer Torah? If they found somebody with the Sefer Torah, that person claimed that it was rightfully theirs, and the community claimed that no, the Sefer Torah belonged to them. In the meantime, there's no Sefer Torah to lean from, and they're going without hearing Kriya Satorah. So can a Dayan sit to adjudicate that case when he serves to benefit from the community regaining the Sefer Torah so that they'll be able to lean from the Sefer Torah when he goes to Shul? And the Gemara says that the Dayan who lives in that community would be prohibited from serving on the case. But if the Dayan would remove himself from that shul, say there was another shul in the community, and the Dayan committed himself that from now on, he's only going to daven, say, in the other shul. He's only going to daven in, up to now he was in North Torah, now he's only going to daven in the Chovev Beit Zion, or whatever, or vice versa. So now he commits himself, he's only going to daven in the other shul, so that the shul where there was this question about the Sefer Torah is no longer going to be directly associated with his interests. So then renouncing that conflict of interest would work for the Dayan to be able to serve in the case. So Tosfos, this is source number 10, ask the question. Satoso says, "Bim katomar, v'abeinan tkilaso v'sofo b'kashrus." But isn't there a need that not only should the person be kosher to serve as a dayan at the end of the case, but even tkilaso at the beginning of the case has to be kosher as well, like with respect to a relative? And here, when the case began, he had an interest in the outcome of the litigation, and therefore it should be like a relative who becomes a non-relative in the middle of the case. Ve'omer Ri, and Tosfos answers in the name of the Ri, delo shayak tkilaso b'paslus hacha, that we don't have the problem of tkilaso b'psul, that the fact that the person originally had a conflict does not bother us here. Hacha kin shein paslus tali b'guf ela b'momun. Since the invalidation here, the disqualification, is not based on the person's essence, the essence of the individual, but rather just the monetary connections, the monetary interest that the person has. Once you remove that monetary interest, then there is no conflict anymore. If the person, as a matter of their essence, they were like a relative, for example, would become disqualified, so that can never be removed. But if the person's essence was never disqualified, it's just that their money had a connection, so that monetary connection and association, once it is removed, can then serve to make the person qualified and permitted to serve as a dayan in this particular case. This also comes up in another context, and this is in source number 14, and that is where you have a judge who hears a case from one party before they hear the case from the other party. So we know this is obviously against the rules. A judge is obligated to hear a case from both parties at the same time, and they're not allowed to hear a case from one side without hearing the case from the other side. But let's say somebody doesn't know that they're going to be serving as a judge in the case, and one person just tells them their story of woe to the judge, and just to get their opinion, to get their guidance, to get their sense of what they should do. And this is not unusual at all, because people who know that they have a dayan in the community, if they're having a difficult time with somebody else, or they're having the possibility of a dispute, it's not unusual that they'll turn to their friend, the dayan, to ask them for some advice without necessarily knowing that the case is eventually going to come in front of the dayan. So the question is the dayan allowed to hear the case afterwards? So the Ramah says that the davka sheyodea dayan, the only time that a judge can hear from one side is if the judge knows that they're going to be the judge in the case, she a dayan bedavar. But if the judge hears from one side and only afterwards that they both parties come to the judge to indicate that they want to hear the case in front of the judge, mutar lios dayan bedavar, then the judge is permitted to serve as a judge in the case. Now, the commentary, the Nesivos, points out that here the halacha has an important distinction between what we call disqualification and what we call duty of disclosure. Says the Nesivos, there's no disqualification in such a case, but there is a duty of disclosure. The judge is not allowed to hear the case with both sides without at least divulging to the second side that they had had a conversation with the first side beforehand, not knowing that they were going to be a judge. If the second side objects and says, I don't want you to be the judge in the case because maybe you've already developed some sort of an inclination in favor of the other side, so then the dayan has to recuse himself. But there is no intrinsic disqualification under these circumstances. The Shach points out that there might be one exception to this rule, and that's source number 15. But the Shach says that Achein, in Kvar Nishal Midayan, if the first side had already asked the dayan his opinion, because of Lo Psak, and the dayan had already written a decision, had written their opinion to this person, had rendered a letter decision saying, based on what you're telling me, I think you're correct, and then the other side wants to hear the case, then the dayan is not allowed, as a matter of a strict disqualification from hearing the case, not only a duty of disclosure, but this will be an actual disqualification. Why? Because he's considered a nogea. Then he's considered to already have a conflict of interest because of the fact that the dayan had written a letter expressing an opinion on this matter, and presumably would be tilted in the direction of wanting to validate the written opinion that had already been rendered in this matter before the other party came into the picture. That would be an actual disqualification. This was a big dispute between the two major rabbis who lived in Israel during the time of the Shulchan Aruch, during the 16th century, when there was the dispute when Smicha had been reinstituted. There was a great rabbi in Sfat named the Maariv Rav, who reinstituted Smicha, decided he gets all the rabbis together of Eretz Yisrael, and they all decide to give Smicha, then Smicha can be reinstituted, and the Maharal Bach, who was a great rabbi who lived in Yerushalayim, wanted to invalidate the entire Smicha because he wasn't invited. because therefore not all of the rabbis had been properly consulted, and Maribei Rav told the Maharal Bach, told the Maribei Rav that in his opinion, even if the entire matter would be reconvened with the participation of the Maharal Bach, there was no way that a proper verdict or decision could be made by the Maribei Rav and his cohorts, because they had already decided this matter. Since they already decided this matter, it wouldn't help if they would reconvene even together with the rabbis who hadn't been invited, because they would never change their original opinion. They would be nogeya bedavar. They would have a conflict of interest in terms of upholding their original opinion. This raises an interesting question, to go back for a moment, and we'll conclude just with this question from the perspective of secular law, whether William Rehnquist, who had been the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the time that the case of Bush versus Gore was decided, whether there was potentially a conflict of interest in Justice Rehnquist being able to hear the case. This is a purely theoretical and whimsical discussion at this point in time, because William Rehnquist is no longer alive, and you could really only engage in this discussion earnestly if he was here to kind of talk about his position. But you may recall that when there was the presidential election in 2000, there was a question about whether there should be a continued recount in the state of Florida for all of the ballots, the undervoted, overvoted ballots, all of the old Jewish women who voted for Pat Buchanan and so forth, and whether the ballots should be revisited and recounted because the differential that was determined up until that point in time between Bush and Gore was only 327 votes, and the entire national election depended upon which way the state of Florida would go. And at some point in early December, the Florida Supreme Court ordered that there should be a continued recount. And then the Supreme Court issued a stay. And then a couple of days later, I think December 12th, the Supreme Court issued a decision upholding the stay and saying that there can't be any further recounts, that there weren't uniform processes, that the whole thing was chaos and a mess, and in order to be able to maintain the stability of the nation, it was necessary to declare Bush the winner, and hence he became president. It's perfectly possible that even if there had been a recount, Bush would have remained the winner, so it doesn't necessarily affect the outcome of the election, but to this day, political pundits debate this point as to what would have happened if the recount would have been allowed. Perhaps we would have been plunged into a major civil war. Who knows what would have happened? But there has always been a little bit of a cloud of suspicion over this case, and I think Justice Sandra O'Connor, years later, was quoted as saying that she thought that maybe it would have been the best thing for the Supreme Court to have just abstained from the case altogether. But what's interesting is that a couple of years ago, there was an article in the American Bar Journal, which I happen to get because I'm a member of the American Bar, being a licensed attorney in the state of New York, and there was an article there called "The William Rehnquist You Didn't Know." Now, most people didn't read this article because they either don't get the American Bar Association or they don't read it because it's a very boring journal. But this this particular article was actually somewhat interesting, and it turned out this person, who was a close friend of the Rehnquist family, got friendly with his wife, and he became friendly with William Rehnquist and his wife. And after William Rehnquist's wife died, they even developed more of a closer relationship, and they started engaging in just kind of like these friendly bets, and they used to bet on elections, at least according to this article. And, you know, the bets would just be for like a dollar here, a dollar there, or whatever. So it turns out that they had actually bet on the election of Bush versus Gore. He writes in the article, "The day before the election, Bill bet George W. Bush would trounce Al Gore by 320 to 218 electoral votes. We also picked Bush, but we thought he would win by substantially smaller margins, blah, blah, blah." And they were kind of, you know, waiting the outcome of the election so they'd figure out who would win the bet. So he writes, "On November 21st, Florida Supreme Court ruled in Gore's favor." I'm not sure of the timing exactly. That was around the time that they had done the first recount, or they had concluded their tallies showing a 327 vote discrepancy. The final Supreme Court decision came, I think, a couple of weeks later. But anyway, clearly things were heating up at that point in time. So he writes, on the same day, Bill faxed the following letter to Betty Nann and me. Dear Obi and Betty Nann, and now this is actually in the source material, source number 16. It now appears, and I'm not in any way vouching for the accuracy of this story. It was published after William Rehnquist had died, and the whole thing could, you know, be debated, but this is just what's in the American Bar Journal. So he writes, he faxed the following letter, and there is not a replication of this particular fax. Dear Obi and Betty Nann, it now appears remotely possible that the Florida election case might come to our court. I therefore feel obliged to cancel all my election bets in any way dependent on the Florida vote. In other words, he was renouncing his potential conflict of interest. I hope you will agree to let me do this. Sincerely, Bill Rehnquist. And the story ends with, needless to say, we did. I mean, come on, you know, the least we could do for our good friend Bill. And then, as we know, the vote of the Supreme Court was actually 5-4. So one vote really would have made a big difference. So I was kind of waiting to see whether anybody was going to pick up, you know, this paragraph from the article, if I was maybe the only person who read the American Bar Journal. So there was one person wrote a response in a subsequent issue, and I don't think anybody even followed up on this, but the person wrote, respectfully, it was a banal article, but for one horrible disclosure. The Chief Justice not only bet for money on presidential elections, but had the audacity to attempt to withdraw from his likely illegal bet when it appeared that his court would decide the 2000 election between de jure President Al Gore and fiat President George W. Bush. The cat was out of the bag. Just as one cannot withdraw from a consummated crime, one cannot eradicate an illegal conflict of interest. I am distressed at the ABA Journal's matter-of-fact publication of this excerpt. So that's an interesting question. So we just mentioned that if we're looking at this from a purely halakhic perspective, from a halakhic perspective, a judge probably can, on some level, eradicate an illegal conflict of interest. That was the case of the Sefer Torah, where the judges have the ability to recuse themselves, at least from the shul where the dispute is taking place, and to affiliate themselves with a different shul so that they will not stand to benefit from the decision of whether the first shul regains its Sefer Torah or does not regain its Sefer Torah. Was this, from a halakhic perspective, a sufficient recusal from the potential conflict of interest? Or do we say that if there was some sort of a recorded bet or recorded guess as to whether one candidate would win the election or the other candidate would win the election, that this was more in the realm of a psak that had been issued, where one was asked their opinion on how a particular case would come out, and where there had been some sort of a determination that was issued, yes, I think that the case would come out a particular way. To that, you can argue, well, this wasn't necessarily a determination of how the case would come out, but just that it would not allow for further recount, although by definition, since at the time the decision was issued, one candidate was in the lead, that would essentially award the election to that candidate. So I think that one could reasonably argue that this type of a speculation does not constitute the equivalent of an actual decision of what should be done under the circumstances, but nonetheless, it's just an interesting application of some of the principles that we are talking about. What I think most fundamentally it illustrates is the importance of taking all of these issues seriously, not only in the realm of what constitutes the obvious conflicts of interest when a person has a clear monetary stake in the outcome of a litigation or the outcome of any type of judicial situation, but also what we were discussing in terms of all of the cases of the Gemara and Ksuvos, of the notion of the Midas Chasidus, of the notion of acting in a way which is above and beyond even the letter of the law, because of the fact that we believe that Kol Dayan Shadan Dinemes Lamito Kilanasa Shuta Kadosh Baruch Hu B'Maaseh Bereishis, that every single judge and judicial proceeding which is done with absolute integrity is considered to be a partnership, as it were, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So all of this just underscores the necessity to conduct ourselves in all of these proceedings, whether we are in the capacity of attorney, witness, or judge or juror, in a fashion which ensures the utmost integrity and which achieves the greatest possible Kiddush Hashem. Thank you very much.
In a situation where the judge has a duty of disclosure, does that then give the right to the other party to say, no, I feel this judge is not impartial, so I don't want to be judged by that? Does that give the right of the other party to refuse to be judged in that situation where the judge has that duty of disclosure?
Generally speaking, whenever there's a duty of disclosure, there is a requirement of recusal on the part of the judge if the other party objects to the judge's continued participation, either as a matter of strict law or as a matter of midas chasidus.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Reese. If anyone has any questions, you can catch them here. Again, our next Kollel Yom Rishon will be on February 9th. Thank you very much for coming. Have a good day.